Hey, okay, Reggie, what do you say we do a little podcasting today? How about that? All right, very good, sir. Instrument ready? Engineer ready? Thumbs up on that side. Very good. All right, three S's, star smile strong. Here we go. You only got one button to punch. Just hit that record button. After I say 3, 2, 1, hit record. All right, here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. Welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNradio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. Of course, we are there. And don't forget, listening is important, but also want you to get out there and tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs, too. That loyalty and devotion that you have shown for so many years, they're both much appreciated. And of course, if you like what you hear, whether you've been listening for the last almost 10 years or the last 10 minutes, don't forget, go to WGNradio.com, go to the podcast section, hit the prompt for this podcast, and lo and behold, there you will find many podcasts that we have previously done are just sitting there waiting for you to either be rediscovered or discovered for the first time, whether you're a long-time listener or a new-time listener. So find out where we've been so you know where we're going. Just scroll down and load more and have some fun. We've been doing this now for almost 10 years and almost 500 episodes, because this is episode 485. 485, we love things with zeros and fives. 15 podcasts away from number 500. Not bad. Wow. Okay. Well, then let's not waste any time. Let's get right to it. If you've been looking at the news online or however you get your news these days, you've probably seen or heard that one of the biggest tours right now musically in the United States, and even around the world, I should say, but now it's just landed here in the United States, is the reunion, the unlikely reunion of the 90s band sensation Oasis, basically made up of the brothers Gallagher, if you will, Liam and Noel. And, of course, Oasis was one of the breakout bands in the early 90s, in the midst of the alt-rock revolution, coming out of the new wave of the 80s. There was this kind of gray period where no one knew exactly where the music biz was going in the late 80s. You had the explosion of the British New Wave for most of the 80s, also heightened by certainly Michael Jackson's Thriller and other kind of pop-oriented albums. The 80s was really a mishmash of a lot of different things. When you think about it, because the British New Wave was so visual and no question about it, dominant with bands like, Duran Duran and Frankie Goes to Hollywood and Thompson Twins and Paul Young. And it really was what they called the second British invasion in the 80s. But there's no question that they're also was a lot of other kinds of music that became just as popular. As I said, Michael Jackson's Thriller is certainly not, new wave. That was kind of pop and funk and R&B. You had the soundtrack albums from especially Dirty Dancing, which kind of brought a revival of old music back. The 60s music got a revival during the 80s with movies like Dirty Dancing. And now I'm totally blanking on the other one. What was the movie with all the... with all the nostalgia. Oh man, come on. Oh man, what I could see the picture of the album cover and all the people dancing to the 60s music. Oh my God. Why can't I remember it? Oh, I will remember it. I promise. I promise. Kevin Costner wasn't in it. Boy, am I blanking on this movie now. Kevin Klein. Kevin Costner was supposed to be in it and he wasn't. Oh my God, I could totally see the thing. I am okay, The Big Chill, of course. Hello. Oh, wow. Whew. Man, talk about a senior moment there. Yeah. Yeah, I mean the Big Chill soundtrack. So 60s music sort of came back between as I said, the Dirty Dancing and then The Big Chill. We just had a very big, you know, we had then big albums by 70s and 60s artists, obviously Prince, which was R&B and funk, and Springsteen, which is kind of heartland rock and roll, and Tina Turner made a huge comeback, and Dire Straits had Money for Nothing. I mean, it was, you know, the Police were the biggest band in the world at one time. You had the emergence of U2. I mean, it was really a smorgasbord of different kinds of music. But when we sort of think of the 80s, we think of the British New Wave because it was so prominent on MTV and the haircuts were kind of that punky. You know, New Wave was kind of a watered-down punk. You know, it was a commercialized punk. And so after that, especially with the synthesizers and the hairdos and all that stuff and the definitively British sound of those songs, Howard Jones... you know, of course, even though they were from Australia, Men at Work, but there was just this influx of European music dominating so much, especially in the early to mid 80s. But then toward the end of the decade, that kind of, as everything does, kind of fades away. And people were then looking more toward, because those albums and that music was so highly produced and so technologically advanced, using the synthesizers and drum machines and different new electronic music gadgets that were getting more use in mainstream songs, and producers were having fun and engineers were having fun trying all these new little sounds and gadgets. And so people started to get burned out on that. And then all of a sudden they went back to a more traditional kind of rock. It was kind of a strip down. And that's where we started to get the beginnings of MTV Unplugged and things like that. And there was this era of the late 80s and early 90s where no one knew exactly where the music was going to go. Where is the new trend? And so for a couple of years, it was really kind of just floating around. And all of a sudden, in the early 90s, you had the explosion of Nirvana with in the whole grunge sound, and this whole reverting back to a more traditional rock sound, the alternative rock sound, if you will, and that exploded in the early 90s and completely changed everything for a while. And that is when Oasis came to be. It was almost in a time where America was kind of taking back the music scene. You know, there was the British invasion of the Beatles in 1965, and then that lasted pretty well into the 80s, or into the, you know, 60s, or, you know, 50s or 70s or so. And then things started to, you know, there's more rock, American rock bands started to emerge. And then all of a sudden, boom, this second wave of the British invasion. And then America said, okay, enough of this. We're taking over. And that's when the grunge and the alt-rock era took place. And even though there were many British bands in it, it was mostly driven by American bands. And it's actually been a while since we've had a third wave or third British invasion. British music has not made that third wave yet, and it's been a while now. But certainly, while Oasis was very popular in the United States, and they had certainly a number of hits here, you know, Champagne Supersonic and Wonderwall and Supernova and Don't Look Back in Anger and things like that, and you know, their albums Definite Maybe from 94 and, you know, What's New, Morning Glory, huge. So big albums, no doubt. Oasis made an impact in the United States. But as I said, at the same time, while Oasis was around in the mid-90s, you also had the rise and fall, sadly, of Nirvana and Pearl Jam and Smashing Pumpkins. And so there was a real emphasis here in the United States on American-grown bands after we just had a decade of this second British invasion. So even though there were some British bands and UK bands making an impact in the alt-rock world, no question about that, Oasis being one of them, it was more of an American-centric kind of movement then, in the 90s as terms as rock goes. Of course, then once again, no decade is dominated by one. We tend to put labels on decades because it's easier for us to categorize them. The 70s were not just disco, right? The 60s was not just the Beatles. And the 80s was not just new wave, and the 90s was not just grunge. Don't forget, in the middle toward the end, we had the rise of pop coming back in a big way, especially the female pop stars with Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera and so many. And then we had the beginning toward the end of the 90s, the explosion of rap and hip hop, which still dominates today, you know, more than 25 years later. So, and it's really a mishmash now because, once again, now you can say that hip-hop and pop music, especially female-oriented, you know, led pop music with so many female popular singers today, obviously Taylor Swift and Katy Perry and Dua Lipa and Chappell Roan and, you know, just the list goes on and on. But at the same time, look at the growth of country music going from a niche to now a very popular mainstream, as country music has adopted a lot of pop elements, not only in sound, but also in performance. So there's no question that country music is just as dominant today in terms of charts and sales and certainly in concert attractions. Country music is right up there now with hip hop and with regular pop music. Generation is just defined by one kind of music. We like to put labels on them, but they're always very diverse. And so, yes, as I said, so Oasis certainly made its mark, but in the UK and around the world, they were huge. They were big here, no question. In fact, the common kind of knock was that Oasis didn't even really like America because they were a little mad that they didn't break as big as they should have in America as opposed to as they did all around the world. And maybe some of that was true. There was this kind of pro U.S. Grown music at the time, because that started to bubble up and create this new alt-rock revolution, and we just had a lot of British. So there may have been something to that, and there was supposedly this kind of feeling that Oasis was not very happy, you know, in terms of with the U.S. market, because they didn't embrace them as big as the rest of the world, especially the U.K., I mean, they've sold over 100 million albums worldwide, which makes them one of the biggest selling bands of all time. But they had 8 number one albums and 8 number one singles in the UK. Now, they had some success. I rattled off a couple of songs like Wonderwall and Supernova and Champagne Supersonic and Don't Look Back in Anger, and there's many more. And they were popular songs. And they were big hits, no question. But in the UK, Oasis was being, at that time, in the mid-90s, Oasis was being compared to the Beatles. And you have to understand, too, once again, you have to put everything in context. In the early 90s and mid-90s, the Beatles were not held in the same regard as they are now. It wasn't until the end of the 90s when the Beatles management and Capitol Records and Apple Records, whoever put it out, wisely said, you know, we need to reintroduce the Beatles to a new generation. The Beatles have always been popular. There's no question. But, you know, in the 80s, the Beatles were not that popular of a group. You know, they had been broken up now for 10, 15 years by the mid-80s. There was this new wave of British bands coming in, and the Beatle music almost sounded old. And even individually, obviously the death of John Lennon, you know, destroyed any hope of a Beatles reunion. But even for the most part, Paul McCartney's 80s output certainly was nowhere near as successful in the 80s as his solo efforts were in the 70s. He was one of the biggest selling and most popular acts in the 70s. Paul McCartney, no question. I mean, Band on the Run and Venus and Mars and all these different singles. McCartney had a very, very successful decade in the 70s. But by the 80s, you know, he was viewed as old. Back then, 40 years old was old. People didn't realize that these guys would still be hanging around when they were in their 80s. Not at that time. You know, George Harrison was spotty with some releases in the 80s, but toward the end of the decade, he made a nice comeback with his Cloud Nine album, and then later, through that, you know, then formed the Traveling Wilburys in the late 80s. But still, they weren't dominant. Ringo really didn't do much in the 80s. He wound up forming his now all-star band, which has remained a very popular concert attraction, but that wasn't until the late 80s as well. So the Beatles as a group or even individually, they were never forgotten, don't get me wrong, but they weren't held in the same esteem as they are now by all generations. It's really been a very well plotted and well executed marketing plan to reintroduce the Beatles, and it really has elevated you know, their reputation now and their legacy. Here's Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr still out on the road in their mid 80s now. McCartney on, you know, Ringo's never really stopped. He's keep putting albums. I think he turned 85, and Paul is, I think, 83. He's going to have a new album out apparently next year. He's starting a North American tour this month. So, the reintroduction of the Beatles started in the late 90s, early 2000s. They wisely put a new greatest hits album out for a new generation. While they had previous greatest hits albums through the last 10 or 15 years since they broke up, those were considered old albums. So they repackaged the albums, they remixed them, or the songs, and they put out an album called One. And they were basically all the Beatles' number one hits. And that turned out to be a huge, huge seller. And it reintroduced the Beatles to a whole generation. That, along with the Cirque du Soleil show that was playing in Vegas for up until just now, the Love show. And then, of course, now then the constant stream of remastered box sets, as well as having McCartney and Ringo still out on the road, people going there for the nostalgia trip of seeing a Beatle. I mean, there's still two left. Sadly, George passed away in the early 2000s, and obviously John was senselessly murdered in 1980. In fact, this year in December will be you know, we will be sadly commemorating the 45th anniversary of his assassination. Very sad day. But yeah, so the reintroduction of the Beatles is relatively new in the last 25 years. And so in the 90s, here came Oasis. Noel and Liam Gallagher writing together, similar to like Paul and John, and just exploding on the British scene in this new alt-rock era, more of a throwback to guitars and drums and the traditional rock and roll sound. And so they exploded. As I said, they dominated the charts during their tenure. But then as as many rock bands, and especially rock bands with brothers, the sibling rivalries just seem to get in the way of success, at least long-term success. The most you know, obvious of these are the Kinks with Ray Davis and Dave Davis. I know we say Davies here in the United States, but it's actually pronounced Davis in the UK. It's spelled I-E-S. So we've always been saying Ray Davies and Dave Davies, but it really is Davis in the UK. The Everly Brothers, brothers are right in the title, right? you know, a strained relationship. These great, they made such great music together. A lot of these sibling bands, and yet the personal issues that went back long before they were successful always seemed to creep in and destroy them. And so, while they were certainly on a winning streak into the 90s, Oasis, it just seemed like these two brothers were always feuding. And I think they infamously broke up during a show and, you know, have never been together. They didn't really speak. It became one of the all-time, you know, sibling feuds. Each one of them, Noel and Liam, went out on their own, forming their own bands, doing things solo, you know, made a little noise, but never, ever did they individually come anywhere close to the success that they had as Oasis. And this was one, just like the Kinks, the Everly Brothers did get together after they broke up back in the 80s for a time, but then again, they broke up again. And so many of the Kinks have never really gotten back together. Even though they had a little spurt of success in the mid-80s with a comeback with Come Dancing and a few different albums during that time. But it just seems like those sibling rivalries, those sibling relationships, they just get in the way when success and creativity comes in. And so that's what happened to Oasis. And they were, I mean, and they used to attack each other in the press all the time. It seemed like this was a reunion that would never happen. Now, of course, the joke back in the 80s, late 70s and then early 80s, when the Eagles broke up, they had a very acrimonious breakup. And Don Henley ultimately said that they would get back together when hell freezes over. Well, as we know, it seems like a lot of times, as warm and hot as hell apparently has been promoted to be, it does occasionally freeze over. And of course, not only do the Beatles, the Eagles get together then back in the mid 90s, but now they've been together for more than 20 years. They put out albums, almost 30 years. They've put out albums, and now they're a huge draw, not only on the concert stage for many, many years, but now they've got this residency at the Sphere. In fact, I think they're starting up again this month at the Sphere. And so, yeah, all these rock and roll breakups many times don't last very long. Even if there's hard feelings and creative differences that have occurred, the money is oftentimes way too tempting to turn back or turn away from. And so even though bands like Pink Floyd have resisted it, or Dire Straits, Mark Knopfler does not want to do the Dire Straits thing anymore. The Police reunited back in 2007, but that never took. That was kind of a cash grab. I guess they just couldn't turn down the money. In fact, I remember after the Police tour in 2007, which was one of the most, you know, successful tours, not only of that year, but of many years, they made, hundreds of millions of dollars. I remember soon after the tour, it was reported that Sting bought a $21 million penthouse in New York. So, you know, for 6 months' work, not a bad payoff, right? I mean, the money that's thrown at them, at some of these legacy bands to reunite, they might have all this integrity and all this creative autonomy and things like that, but when the real numbers come at you, I don't care who you are and how dedicated to your art you are, there comes a point where you're also a business person, and those numbers and all those zeros are pretty hard to turn away from. And we're seeing right now the Who on their at least fourth or fifth farewell tour. The first one happened 43 years ago. I know, because I was there. And they've had several final tours. It almost become a joke. And even after this, this final North American tour, it's called The Song Is Over. Well, they're already making kind of hints that, well, maybe it's not totally over. So, yeah, there's some bands that have stuck to their guns. As I've said, they have not gotten back together. A band like Supertramp, which was huge in the 70s and especially in the 80s. If they were to reunite with some of the songs that they had, especially their Breakfast in America album, oh, my gosh. But, the two main people, including Roger Hodgson, they don't want to do it. As I said, Dire Straits, one of the best-selling and most popular international bands, not only here in the United States because of Brothers in Arms in 1985, but just around the world. They were huge, huge, huge. They could just, oh. And now members of the Dire Straits, they get together and they've got some kind of a quasi-tribute band, but there's no Dire Straits without Mark Knopfler, let's be honest. The most unlikely reunion, especially not only because they hadn't been together for 16 years, but because there seemed to be such a legitimate hatred and anger and a sibling rivalry or a sibling, whatever you want to call it, between Noel and Liam Gallagher, the chances of an Oasis, it actually became a joke. Like, yeah, well, that'll happen when Oasis gets back together. You know, I mean, that's how unlikely it was that this band would ever get back together. And lo and behold, for whatever reason, and I think I know the reason, and it had a lot of dollar signs behind it, somehow, when there's enough zeros offered to you, when an olive branch appears, it seems like both sides can somehow put aside those differences, no matter how deep felt and no matter how long they have existed. It seems like, money can certainly change people's minds. And I think not only money, but other things happen in there. I think there's no question that the money in Oasis was a driving factor. As I said, Noel and Liam Gallagher, had solo careers, but they never came close to duplicating the success they had as Oasis. So there's no question that the reunion money from a tour potential was a motivating factor. But also, they're both in their 50s now. And so, you start to feel your age and you start to think about your legacy. And you say, yeah, you know, people remember Oasis. There's those songs that I mentioned. And they, when we're talked about, when the 90s are talked about, yeah, Oasis will get mentioned. But were they top of the mind anymore? Was their music being gobbled up? As I said, this reinvention, this reintroduction to a new generation, just as I said, like the Beatles did in 2000 or so. And so I think there's also the legacy standpoint and the feelings of mortality to say, okay, well, you know, we've been out of the limelight and there's ego involved. You know, hey, and right now in the rock world, and I've talked about this on many occasions, there's a huge void. There are no big rock and roll sensations. There isn't a rock music equivalent of Taylor Swift out there. And that's why you see so many bands of the last 30, 40, 50, 60 years continuing to tour. Because they know that audiences, there's still a huge audience for rock and roll music, even though it no longer is the dominant music in terms of new contemporary music and new contemporary artists and the charts. There's enough of an audience from the past who are still longing to hear their music. And there are rock fans who, even younger people, who maybe were brought up on this music by their parents, but there's no sensation band. And I'm sure that people can, oh, what about this? What about, I'm just talking, there's no rock band that is on the level of Taylor Swift. And that's what I'm talking about. 40 years ago, 50 years ago, there was several of them. There was Led Zeppelin. There was Pink Floyd. There were several on that Taylor Swiftian kind of dominant level. There was The Who. There still was the Rolling Stones. There were bands like that. And rock has been slowly declining over the last 25 years. That's no lie. Yes, there's been some bands that are popular. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about sensations. I'm not talking about Foo Fighters and things. That's still, yes, popular, yes. Not Taylor Swift popular. In the 70s and 80s, there were a long, long list of Taylor Swift-like bands and now in the rock world. And now that doesn't exist. So that's why you still see The Who out there. You still see Paul McCartney out there. You still see, even Pearl Jam from that era out there. You still see U2 out there. You still see the Eagles out there. You still see the Grateful Dead out there. Because there is still an audience for it. The window is closing. But absent a current contemporary major rock star or rock band that's on the level, and I mean pure rock, I don't mean pop rock, I mean pure rock. I know a lot of people can make some arguments for some current people, but I'm sorry, I'm talking about Taylor Swift kind of popularity. There isn't a band, and there hasn't been a rock band like that for many years. And so that's why you see some of these older acts still out there and still selling out. Because their fan base is still clutching for that music. And a younger generation that maybe, as I said before, that were raised on that, maybe by their family, are looking around, family members are looking around saying, geez, well, I mean, there's nobody my age, you know, doing this, so I'm going to like these other bands. And so whatever the motivating factor was, hell froze over once again. And for whatever reason, Lowell and Noel Gallagher have gotten back together. When they made the announcement last year that Oasis was getting back together, this is not a drill, this is really happening. I mean, they even played into the hype of it because it seemed like the most unlikely reunion, that they actually addressed it and embraced the fact that the odds of them getting together seemed crazy. And there was even questions if this armistice was even going to be real when they first, there were rumors last summer that, well, you know, Lowell and Lee and Liam Gallagher are apparently talking again. And well, yeah, okay, right. Well, they've done that before. And then one throws a beer bottle at the other and it's never, and then that's over. But I think this time the combination of a lot of factors, this void I'm telling you about, in the concert world, in the rock world, this idea of a lot of money to be made here, guys. Yeah, you have a nice lifestyle. You want one of those penthouses that I told you that Sting bought in New York City overlooking Central Park? It's going to cost you 20 or 30 million. Yeah, you're making some royalties off your records. But you want some new cash? Merch alone. Forget the concert tickets. It's the merch stand where they make their money these days. Whether it was the age factor of both of them, whether it was the legacy factor, it's whatever happened, all the stars aligned, and Noel and Liam decide to get together again. They announced the tour, and no surprise, because of this void and because of this hype, once again, a well-executed marketing plan. The Oasis reunion is announced. The tickets go on sale. First, the tour starts in Europe. Then it comes to the United States. And within hours, these shows sell out. And suddenly, it's Oasis fever. As unlikely as that we have seemed even 2 years ago. Now, we are in the midst of Oasis fever here, not only in Europe, but in the United States. And that's what it's even more interesting. You know, U.S. has always been a rock and roll country, right? I mean, it started here. And even though at the time, as I said, Oasis was setting records and was experiencing tremendous success throughout the world, and certainly in the UK, from where they were from in Manchester, and while they, as I said, they had popularity here, but the irony is that not only was it Oasis mania in Europe, but there was Oasis mania here in the United States, and I think it even took the band by surprise, and they've even been addressing that on stage when they've come here. They said, "You know, everybody says that we hate you, but we love you." I mean, that wasn't made up. Those rumors, at least, were really out there, and they've addressed them from the stage. And the outpouring of admiration and love that Oasis fans, not only in Europe but here in the United States, are showing, I think even the band is surprised. You know, in the last 30 years. Their music may have become, you know, they, once again, it was the music of a generation. It was the music of the Gen Xers. Alt rock is Gen X music, even though some of the alt rockers and some of the grungers, like, you know, Billy Corgan and Eddie Vedder, you know, they're still baby boomers. They were kind of born. There's a weird little line between a baby boomer and a Gen Xer. They're right on the line, and they were certainly influenced by all the baby boom rock bands like Black Sabbath and Deep Purple and Bruce Springsteen, you name it. I mean, you know, they were in Cheap Trick. They were all influenced. That's when they grew up. So the irony is that, you know, the people that drove this kind of new alt explosion and this Gen X music, they really were kind of baby boomer Gen Xers. They weren't completely in that generation. They're right on the cusp. But regardless, they have come to symbolize that. And so the 90s alt rock music is the Gen X music, which is really what I want to talk about. Is I think everybody, especially even Oasis, is shocked at this reaction to this tour. In fact, I'm sure this tour is going to continue. And who knows if they make a new album, but they are filling football stadiums up multiple nights all around this country. They only played one night in Chicago. They easily could have played three, I think. I mean, this city went nuts. There were pop-up stores before. Everybody, I mean, as I said, the merchandise, I bet you the Oasis merchandise is selling more than the concert tickets. You know, once again, you have to remember, you know, Taylor Swift made $1 billion in merchandise alone. People would get to the concert 3 or 4 hours, Beyonce, 4 hours before the concert just to get the merch. And that was happening at the Oasis show, especially with one show. When it sold out, it was gone. They had a pop-up store, in the hipster areas of Chicago, and people were out in line 2 or 3 days before that to get their Oasis merch. There's some big money to be made. You say, well, why? Well, I mean, hey, people have always bought T-shirts and hoodies at concerts going back to the 70s. Yeah. But the difference is that now we all take pictures of ourselves. Yeah, you know, I'd come back from a concert and I'd have the new concert T-shirt that I just bought and I'd wear it the next day. Yeah, I went to that concert that everybody was talking about. Yeah, I was there and I'd proudly wear my T-shirt. But how many people saw it? Whoever happened to see me walking around the street. But now the whole world could see me with my Oasis T-shirt. I was there. That's what the T-shirts are all about, especially the concert ones. I was there. Me, once again. Well, now you can broadcast that you were there, not just to your neighborhood, not just when you go out and whoever might encounter you on the street. You can literally tell the world that you went to the Oasis concert. You are cool. Look at me. I was there. You might not even be an Oasis fan, but that's become now a big event. So you go to the Oasis concert. You buy an Oasis T-shirt. I think I may have told you 2 or 3 years ago I was doing a play, and there was a high school girl who was in the play, and she would be coming to every rehearsal with a different classic rock band T-shirt. Because now, as you know, those old vintage band T-shirts are now cool and hip. Because it's nostalgia. And so this girl came in every day with a different shirt. And one day she had this AC/DC shirt. Now, she seemed like a very nice young woman. I think she was 17 or 18. She didn't seem like she was an AC/DC fan, you know, some hard rock, you know, headbanger. So one day at rehearsal, I went up to her and I said, oh, so you got, AC/DC, Back in Black. You know, I said, I was at that tour. You know, she looked at me like I was 500 years old. And I said, what's your favorite AC/DC song? And she just looked at me. She didn't know any AC/DC songs. It was just cool to wear a vintage rock, black rock T-shirt, which now they're selling everywhere, you know, at Walmart and Target. And you name it, online, you know, they're all over the place. You see young people always wearing these old vintage T-shirts, many of which I still have the original versions of many of them. Now they're much smaller than they used to be. I really can't wear them, but I have them. But yeah, so there's a whole nostalgia thing around the vintage rock. It's just there was, and it's nothing new. As I said, you know, in the 70s, then thanks to the film American Graffiti and then Happy Days, there was a great, it seems like there's always a 20-year, 25-year nostalgia thing. So it's no surprise that right now we're having a nostalgia of the mid to late 90s. Because here we are in 2025, so we're at the late 90s, early 2000s. In the 80s, we look back to the 60s. As I told you, Big Chill, Dirty Dancing. In the 70s, we look back to the 50s, American Graffiti, Rock Around the Clock, Buddy Holly. It's always seems to be like a 20 to 25 year kind of nostalgia look back. And so it's not surprising that that's happening. But I have to tell you that I'm shocked at the enormity of this Oasis reunion. As I said, I think the band themselves are shocked. But as I saw this Oasis fever now just, just tidal waving across the country here, and I would not be surprised if they come back next year and this is winds up being a 2 or 3 year tour, because clearly I think they underestimated the demand. No question. As I said, they could have easily done 2 if not 3 shows here in Chicago. Easily. Certainly 2. And filled up 65,000 seats at Soldier Field. And I'm sure they could have done that around the country. So I think that now there's going to be even more demand because they did so few shows in some of the major cities that they'll probably come back again. It's inevitable. There's the demand is there. And so, yes, there's nostalgia. There's the hip factor. There's this void I'm talking about. There's all these issues that make this tour right now, this Oasis tour, one of the biggest in the world. And to take nothing away from the accomplishments of Oasis, to their credit, they're playing a hit-filled set. And as I said, either there's younger fans who now were turned on to Oasis by their parents, their Gen X parents, as well as the Gen Xers going, hey, that's my music, as well as even some of the older people saying, hey, I need my fix of live rock, and there's nobody filling it here contemporarily. So, yeah, let me go see one of these older bands. Whatever the reason, Oasis is definitely capitalizing on it, and they are the cool concert tour right now in the rock world. No question. But here's to me what I was seeing when I saw this, because you're showing all the footage from the concerts and everybody singing these songs as if they're Hey Jude. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, Oasis had some big hits. Wonderwall, as I said, Don't Look Back in Anger, Supernova, Champagne Supersonic. I understand. But the audience reaction seems over the top as what you'd expect, especially here in the United States. Oasis was popular, yes, but they weren't the sensation that they were across the pond. But when you're seeing these concerts, you would think they were. And I think there's something going on here. And you know me, I always have to look at the other side. You know, that's my thing. And so while I'm watching all these people line up at the pop-up stores for their Oasis bucket hat, or their black Oasis hoodie, or their black Oasis t-shirt. And hey, I love to wear black. I'm surprised that I haven't bought it yet. I liked Oasis, as I said. They weren't huge here. I have their main albums. There are 2 or 3 big albums here, no question. Bought them at the time, enjoyed them. But, don't forget, that whole grunge thing, and that whole alt-rock thing got so big so fast that it also burned out very quickly. And when Kurt Cobain died, a lot of the air came out of the grunge world, and there was this rise of the alt-rock that was still dominant, but it burned so fast. It was so popular, so fast, so hard that it went away, and that was the rise, as I said then, to the mid and late part of the 90s. You had the rise of the pop divas, the Britney Spears and the Christina Aguileras and people like that, as well as then the growth of hip-hop, and especially people like Eminem and stuff like that. And then it just it's blown up, Snoop Dogg and things like that. But there was a time when alt-rock was the music of that generation in the mid-90s. Okay, well, once again, this is not rocket science, and this is not just opinion. It's just based on fact. As I said, we look back at 20 or 30 years, and we get nostalgic. That's where our nostalgia comes in. Well, Wonderwall, for instance, and Morning Glory, those came out in 94, 95. Well, that's 30 years ago, right? So if you were 15 or 20 or 23 or 22, that was your music. That was the music you were listening to. That was the music you were growing up with. And now you're in your late 40s and early 50s, just like the band members are. And you're getting you're feeling a little older. You're feeling a little distanced from the zeitgeist of the pop culture that's happening now. It happens to everybody. You're starting to feel a few more aches and pains physically you never did. You're starting to feel a little older. You start to see a few gray hairs and a few little crow's feet. They never were there before. And I know that 50 is the new 30 and all that BS, but tell your body that. Tell your hair follicles that. it happens to all of us. And when I see the kind of frenzy that the Oasis tour has whipped up here, especially here in the United States, I can't help but think, well, yes, the band was popular and they had their fans 30 years ago. And so those fans are out there saying, boy, this was my band and I'm so glad to see them. But the frenzy, the buzz, the mania means that there's something else going on. And you know what I think it is? I think the popularity of this Oasis tour, which will, I think will continue, is not only nostalgic, not only filling a void for rock fans. What it really is, and get ready to swallow this bitter pill, I think it marks the official announcement that Gen Xers are officially old. That's right. Gen Xers, you are officially old. 30 years ago, the marketing world, the television world, everybody was catering to Gen X, Gen X, Gen X. The baby boomers that had dominated the culture for so long, longer than others, were giving way to Gen X. I mean, now, of course, we hear about millennials and Gen Y and even Gen Z. It's getting younger and younger. And Gen X got sort of, while it was so dominant in the late 90s and early 2000s as far as marketing and, you know, and Friends and that whole thing, it went away very quickly for some reason. Gen X lost its power. I don't know if the physical numbers of the Gen X generation population were there as compared to the baby boomers, but Gen X, just like the alt rock movement, just like the grunge music, it burned fast and hard, but fast. And the millennials seemed to sneak up and sort of grab the Gen X generation's thunder a little quicker and earlier than you would have expected. And now Gen Y and Gen Z have done the same thing to millennials, especially during COVID. Millennials are so social and they couldn't go out. You know, back in 2019, before the pandemic, you know, there was a popular phrase going around with the younger generation saying, yeah, okay, boomer, whatever, boomer. You know, I don't need you to tell me how great things were or how great you were. You screwed up the world. Okay, boomer, whatever you say, boomer. Okay, boomer was becoming a very popular, dismissive response to the baby boom generation. But the millennials kind of lost their steam for the 2 or 3 years of COVID because millennials were always out being social and you couldn't be social. And somewhere in the transition during COVID, Gen Y and Gen Z kind of snuck in there. But once again, it leaves Gen X really in the dust. I mean, the boomers now, you know, they're in their 70s and 80s and late mid to late 60s. They're invisible. Still around. They still, they invented pickleball, whatever. But, this is a youth culture. It's always been a youth culture, but even more now. There is a lot more ageism than there was, I think, in the past. Because the generations, the younger generations, are rising up quicker than they used to. Now teenagers, as I've said many times, teenagers, not even 14-year-olds, but 10-year-olds are driving the pop culture bus now. But the Gen X generation, I think, this Oasis tour is an official benchmark to say you are officially old. You are craving your nostalgia. You are craving to feel younger again. You are craving to feel like what we had is the coolest thing ever, even though the culture is telling you differently. Every generation has gone through it, and it's usually when that generation gets older and they feel as if they're being pushed away for the next generation to come in, and they don't feel that they're driving it anymore. And so they reach back for the touchstones of their youth to not only make themselves feel better and feel relevant and young, but also to show this younger generation, well, look how cool we are. Look how cool we were. And I think this Oasis tour is doing that. I'm seeing all these people wearing this Oasis stuff, and I'm seeing people in their late 40s and early 50s wearing it. They're clearly going back to their teens and their early 20s youth. No question about it. And as I said, this is nothing new. This is not an indictment against the Gen Xers. This is the natural progression. It happens to all of us. It happens to every generation. It happens to every person. But when I've been watching this Oasis frenzy, I'm like, this is a huge nostalgia, and this is a huge generation gap grab of, hey, we're Gen X, and we had cool stuff, and this is cool. It was cool 30 years ago, and it's still cool, and we're going to show you how cool it is. There's nothing wrong with that because every generation has done it. You know, back in 1971, Frank Sinatra was like 59 or 60 years old, and he announced he was retiring. He, after dominating the entertainment world from the 40s to the 70s, for the most part, certainly the early 60s, for a good 20 years, Frank Sinatra, movies, television, obviously music, major star. But by 1959, with the 1970, 71, with the not only the coming of the Beatles, but now even the Beatles gone, but rock firmly established now is not just a fad. Frank, with his lonely crooner songs or his big razzmatazz bands and his tuxedos and his crooning style, well, that was viewed as passé. He was feeling for the first time in his life and career, he was feeling out of the groove, out of the vibe, out of the zeitgeist. And so he retired. Well, of course, it didn't take. As I've said many times, anybody who is in the entertainment industry, they never retire. The industry retires you in many cases, but you never retire. if you're an entertainer or a creative type, especially if you've had some fame and success, you never retire. You don't want to retire. The industry, the audience, sometime will tell you. They will retire you. But sometimes you will see people come back in their 70s and 80s. They can't stay away, even if they've been away for 40 years. If there's a hint that there's some kind of buzz about them, they come flying back as if they were never gone. Entertainers, if they tell you they retired, they don't retire. They can't. It's in their blood. It's who they are. The industry retires you, but very seldomly do they stay retired. So, Frank Sinatra, for instance, retired in 1971. Well, by 1974, Frank came back in grand style. And it culminated in a series of concerts at Madison Square Garden in New York. That's Frank, right? It was called the Main Event. Madison Square Garden was always known as hosting some of the biggest boxing matches of all time. Still in the 70s, boxing was a huge, huge sport. You still had Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier and people like that. It was still one of the major sports. Now you don't hear about boxing as much, but 50 years ago, boxing was still huge. It was huge in the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s and still in the 70s. And even into the 90s then when Mike Tyson came, it kind of faded after Mike Tyson and Evander Holyfield as cultural views of boxing changed, even though now you look at this this martial arts stuff. I mean, my God, that's even more brutal than boxing. So what are we talking about? But there's no question that boxing has lost its prominence in the sport, in the sporting world. I mean, whoever used to be the heavyweight champion of the world, they were one of the biggest stars in the world. And now tell me who the world champion boxer is. You used to know Muhammad Ali. You used to know Joe Frazier. You used to know Joe Lewis. You knew Mike Tyson. You knew Evander Holyfield. You knew George Foreman. You don't know, you knew Rocky Marciano. You don't know anymore. It's just true. But anyway, Sinatra came back in 1974. Now remember, 1974, right? This is the height of the hard rock, heavy metal world. You've got Zeppelin. You've got Pink Floyd. You've got The Who, you got The Stones, you got Elton John, you got Bruce Springsteen. Well, not Springsteen. He was around, but he wasn't big at that time. But I mean, you've got, this is the rock era, 1974. I mean, this is the rock era. And yet Frank comes back, did six, I think, sold out shows at Madison Square Garden called the Main Event. The stage was even in a boxing ring, right? The champion returns. And for this brief moment, it was a last grab from the big band, so-called Greatest Generation, for them to relive their youth and grab another moment in the sun. They came to Madison Square Garden while kids and hippies were going to see rock concerts there in T-shirts and blue jeans and flannels and halter tops. And and ponchos. When Frank came to Madison Square Garden in 1974 for his Main Event concerts, they were wearing tuxedos and suits, and women were wearing pearls and furs and diamonds and high heels. It was a throwback to their time when they used to go out and go dancing and go to the nightclubs. And it was a big affair to see a live show in a nightclub or in a theater. You know, this whole idea of arenas and football stadiums, that was a new thing. The Sinatras of the world really didn't play to those a lot until the end of their career, but not at the beginning. There was mostly small, intimate kind of places. But for those concerts, it was a chance for that Greatest Generation, that World War II generation, to grab at least for a day or two or a few hours, relive their youth and see their idol, Frank Sinatra, with his tuxedo, the way they wanted to see him, singing their songs. They were dressed up and they were feeling like, hey, folks, with all your rock and roll, here's the chairman of the board. This is the real thing. Just like today, people are saying, hey, hip hop people, hey, rock, the Oasis is cool. You know, the same thing happened with Simon and Garfunkel. You know, one of the huge acts of the 60s, they got together for a concert in Central Park. It was a huge, huge, 500,000 people. They made an album from it, a TV. You can still see it on PBS stations. They hadn't been together since 1969 or 1970. It was only 12 years, but oh my God, Simon and Garfunkel back together. They always were feuding. They almost were like brothers. And then they got back together again in 2003 for a concert tour. Once again, the baby boomer generation kind of flexing its muscles as they're seeing their impact and influence leaving the generations. You know, Zeppelin broke up because John Bonham died in 1980, but they got back together in 85 at Live Aid. They got back together, I think, for something in 88. Then they got together the last time in 2007, which was the last time the three remaining members got back together. And that's been it. But that was this last grab to say, hey, this was cool. This was our music. Springsteen was the same way. Broke up the E Street Band pretty much in 1985. And then got back together with them in 1999. And it was a huge deal. And now they've been together, you know, ever since. The Stones have gotten back together on and off for many times. And here they are in their 80s. As I said, the Who's still doing it. So this is not, you know, the Eagles I mentioned before, having these reunions. This is nothing new. And the reason that they get back together, it's, as I said before, the factors of them as creative artists, to wanting to be seen again, to be felt as being relevant, also with an eye on their legacy, and also with an eye on their bank account. And for their audience, it's a chance to feel, at least for a while, that we're still cool, that our stuff is still better than yours. This happens all the time. You hear me always talking about, in my day, it's not that I'm a curmudgeon. This is what we all do. And as what I'm saying, for the first time now, I think this Oasis concert is a touchstone. It's, hey, Gen X, welcome to the club. You're officially old. But don't worry. It's still fun. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNradio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 485. I'm Jim Toronto. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. From the end of my mind to your ears.